Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. We're on WYPR, and you can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. And we have a couple things going on today. We want to talk about cooking with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a super interesting thought, and I know Cindy has very specific thoughts, and I have very specific experience with little crazy ones.
Mm-hmm.
To do that, and you can give us a ring on that topic if you like. I was also going to take, I'm just back from the northeast of Italy, and Cindy and I were talking about it, and there are so many sort of misperceptions and cliches about that part of Italy and traveling to Italy that we'll have a little give and take about that topic as well, and you're welcome to call with your own experience or your own comments or favorites. And then we have a few listener emails as well.
Yeah,
we want to get
exciting.
To. So
this morning I was having breakfast and I started watching a documentary on Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers on HBO, which I did not watch when I was a kid. That was not something my mom, I don't know, not for any reason other than we just didn't watch it. But I know you did.
Yeah, I watched it every day.
Oh, my gosh. And I think the documentary
I mean, I have a cardigan that I put on when I go home.
Aww.
A green, like a soft
that's
green,
so cool.
Sage green cardigan, yeah.
Well, it made him so approachable. You know, he comes in, he sits down, he takes his work shoes off and his jacket off and puts on a cardigan and sneakers or whatever. And, you know, just starts
sort
talking.
Sort of like Keds.
Yeah. But I think it's fascinating because, first of all, I didn't know he was an ordained minister, and he never talked about that. That wasn't something, it was just a part of him, his person. But I think it's really fascinating how much he cared about children, connected with children, and the amount of research he did with other people, Dr. Spock and some other people, about childhood behavior and how children can be helped and how they should be communicated with. And that was his whole thing, was communicating with children and trying to get them to open up and talk and say their fears or, you know, whatever they're dealing with. And I think about that because, well, I was actually very emotional about it, quite frankly, because, you know, he was starting in the 60s and I was born in 1964. And by 1970, my oldest sister had passed away from leukemia. And I know what I went through as a child, you know, and what my parents went through and all my siblings went through having lost an older sister and, you know, just there was no communication about it. There was no talking about it. I mean, I know to this, you know, recently found out through my sister that my parents never even told my brother and sister, who are much older than me, what was going on with Kathy. They just knew
that's
she just went
tough.
To the hospital. Yeah. And
that's just tough.
It is. And if I had someone talk to me the way that he talked to children about all the things that go on, it would have helped me so much.
Well, I mean, kids are people that have to deal with stuff. And so our thought being that a safe place to at least begin communicating with your kids is food. It's in the kitchen. Everyone wants to know what's for lunch.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to, like, you know, if you're not working on the weekend in the morning and you get up and, you know, you're your dad that makes breakfast, then that's a big deal. So, I mean, that's it. It is for me. I mean, even if it's just something silly, like I'll go and I'll see a whole bunch of farmers in the morning and pick up stuff for restaurants, but I'll stop at a stand and pick up muffins that these ladies make or, you know, and try to guess at what my kids are going to like and things that we can cook. And I mean, my 2-year-old, who is crazy, as I'm sure no one else has a 2-year-old that's crazy, right? But she, I mean, I, you know, crushed all my tomatoes and I was making the last sauce of the summer this morning. Crushed all my tomatoes and, you know, prepped all my onions and my garlic and ground the
They were there
the
with
other
you
seasonings.
Helping
you? And the 5-year-old was definitely doing her own thing. The 2-year-old was on a chair next to me at the counter.
That's cute.
Leaned over, inspecting the tomatoes as I would crush them. That one's very flat, Dad.
Oh,
and
that's cute.
So I get all of that done and I have 2 big basil stems and she's like, you brought flowers. And I'm like, no, that's basil. It's for your tomato sauce. And so she's like, I want to help that. like, just pick the basil.
That's great.
Just smell it, you know. And she tasted the raw tomatoes, and she smelled the garlic and the onions, which were like, ugh. I'm like, you watch. You're going to love this sauce, but you're going to dislike everything going into it before it's cooked.
It will come out to be a wonderful thing. Well, and she's only two. I mean, you know, just the fact that you're already enlightening her with smells and the way that things taste and how beautiful nature is and raw food product. And also, you're also teaching her about your own family history and your culture and our culture of Baltimore. I mean, everything about cooking is part of our culture.
But it's also your personal priority. And you know what? I spent an hour and a half doing this, but I spent an hour and a half sharing it. And I discover, of course, that she didn't want to wear clothes today. So, you know, she spent the whole time in her Moana underpants in the kitchen picking basil. And you know what? You can do that.
At your house.
You
can
do that, yeah.
Well, and as she gets older, then you can talk, you know, that's a time that you can share, that you can ask her questions and say, you know, are you scared about this today because this happened and you saw it on, you know, you kids talking about it at school.
Because it's safe to communicate.
Exactly.
Back and you know what? There's scary things about the kitchen. Knives are scary. Mm-hmm. Being up by the counter for the two-year-old, I have, you know, like giant crazy knives. I've got a block full of them. And, you know, one laying out on the counter for working on tomatoes. And she knows you can't touch that. Knives are scary. They bite, you know, they bite and they hurt. And if you're standing on that chair, you might fall. So don't stand on this edge and don't stand on that. You know,
it's a lot of lessons that can be learned.
When you have the little one, you're also, I mean, I'm in terror dad all the time. It's always, you know, always careful on the stair. Like,
sure.
And I probably over-communicate some of that stuff because I was a dad a little bit later than some folks are. But not to discount anyone else's terror for their for their children on a constant basis. But it is such an easy place to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And also to teach, like, about taking care of yourself and taking care of your own things and putting your cup away. And
exactly.
You know,
and how to clean and everything. It also makes me wonder why that
isn't part of like a curriculum that people are engaged in food in schools.
It should be.
Because kids will actually talk about that.
Yes. Well, I think every school should have a cooking class. I know that we don't have the money for a lot of things, but I, you know, it's between music and arts and honestly, I think cooking should be included in that because we all need to know how to feed ourselves and we should all have a basic understanding of, you know, how do you deal with sanitation and, you know, how do I keep myself healthy? What do I need to eat that really will keep my body happy? How do I tell if fruit is fresh or chicken is fresh or fish is fresh?
That's all the basics of cooking.
How to scramble an egg. I mean, if I had to live off of scrambled eggs, I could. You know, I mean, it's if you just know how to do basic things, at least you can feed yourself. And then you can grow from there.
I mean, growing up, and we're about the same age.
We are the same. What do you
mean
about?
We're almost the same age. God. Someone is younger.
Yes, I'm like eight months older than you or something. Come on.
So, but it's interesting. The person that I could talk to about whatever when I was growing up was my great-grandmother, and she was born in 1890. Mm-hmm. But we always spent time in the kitchen together.
Mm-hmm. And those are amazing memories, aren't they?
She's the one that taught me to do things. And to work with my hands and to smell things and to choose things. And, you know, that this corn is better than that corn. And, you know,
and in the 60s, we didn't have a lot of great local product or product from anywhere to deal with. I mean, we grew up at a time when, you know, you couldn't buy shallots. You can get prosciutto at the store. I mean, all these wonderful things that are available to us now. So learning, especially back then when product was inferior, quite frankly, unless you were growing it in your own garden.
It was not all inferior.
Well, but I mean, okay, I'm not ringing the good old days chime.
Availability was much more limited, is probably what I should say. But you can join the conversation. You can reach us 410-662-8780. Talk about the things that you cook with your kids, especially at what ages? At what age do you think it's safe or reasonable for them to learn to work with a knife? And I mean, people need to know how to work safely with a knife.
Mm-hmm. And how to deal with the heat of the stove, which obviously, I mean, they have to be older for that. But
yeah.
I mean, how not the dangers to use a wet, of working in a kitchen.
not using a wet dish towel to pick up something hot because the
right heat or even is... water on the floor, which you can slide on. I mean, there are just so many things that are practical about working in a kitchen that teach you life lessons, and also how to work with someone, being a team. I mean, because that's in the end, what you're doing, doing it together. Yeah, if you and your daughter are making something together, you're a team doing it together, whether you recognize it or not. And how well do you work together? And are you listening to each other? And it's, I mean, there's so much that can help with life lessons. But to me, it's the time. Just listening to how he paid attention to children.
As long as no one makes you clean artichokes, do you know that they love you? And if no one makes you pick fava beans.
Oh, I like picking fava beans. I think it's fun. All right. So your
there's
child
no
suffer, should...
There's no suffering in picking fava beans.
No, I love it. No. Oh, my gosh. I was just cleaning lima beans the other day, and I'm like, oh, God, I feel
they,
like...
They need to be twice as good as any other bean because it's in two husks.
Well, that was, you know, you're talking about your grandma. My grandma, used to make, my grandmother was Pennsylvania Dutch, so would make green beans and ham. Oh, my goodness, which I loved. But it takes a whole lot of green beans to make a big pot of green beans and ham because you cook them down so long and they turn into nothing. And so we would sit out back. She had those iron chairs, you know, that had the holes in the back that kind of were like rocker things. I loved those chairs. We would sit out back and pick green beans and... snap off the ends, and we'd do probably 10 pounds at a time. You know, we'd do a lot of beans, 5 pounds, 10 pounds, depending on how many people were there. But I mean, one of the other things, you know, of my family history is hog maw, and to have, like, I know how to make hog maw because of my grandmother and my mother. I don't know anybody that makes hog maw. I mean, I've never heard anybody talk about making hog maw in this, you know, and we're actually in that country or that region of making it. I mean, even finding, it's the lining of the pig stomach, that's what the hog maw is, and you stuff it with sausage, pork sausage and potatoes, and
yeah,
you bake it. It's
stuffed,
just a gigantic
tripe or almost
or it's like a, gigantic sausage, you know,
Pennsylvania Dutch haggis.
Okay, but it's like one of the best things I've ever eaten in my life. And in the hog maw itself, or the pig's lining, stomach lining, becomes this golden brown mass that is like one of the best things you'll ever eat in your life by the time it's done baking. And I'm very thankful that I know how to do that. And that is a very important part of our family history. And my mom also used to make pot pie, which she would make by my grandma, stewing a whole chicken, having this incredible broth, pulling all the meat off the chicken, setting it aside, and then making a very simple egg dough and rolling it out and using a pie cutter to cut it into squares. And then she just dropped what is essentially a noodle, but it's in the shape of a square, into the rolling broth. And then she would add the picked meat back. And I mean, that and sauerkraut and pork were those three dishes were my favorite ever. And I was talking to my mom the other day, and I made chicken corn soup, which is another very traditional Pennsylvania Dutch. I made it at Charleston. And what I did was we had gotten in some great corn from Ian at Richfield Farm, and I roasted it. We roasted it in the husk, cut it off the cob, and we had bought these chickens that were just incredible, and made some really good broth, not stock, but broth, meaning that there's meat in there, not just bones. That's the difference between a stock and a broth. And I added polenta to it. So for 5 gallons of good chicken broth, I added 4 cups of polenta, which is actually stone ground for us by a mill in Charleston, and let that roll until the polenta cooks, and then added the roasted corn, added a little bit of chicken meat back to it, and then on pickup we added, not Pennsylvania Dutch in any way, a little bit of fresh lime juice and cilantro, and that's the influence of the guys that I work with in my kitchen. And I mean, that was one of the best things ever. And
it was
something
that was a little bit more like a porridge because of the,
you know what,
the polenta.
It wasn't. It was just a little, because I put so little polenta in.
Okay.
It was just enough to give it some viscosity, but it was not thick in any
way. It
was
much more about the corn and much less about the...
Yeah, I just added the polenta because it just adds more corn flavor. Yeah. And, you know, it just fortified that broth and made it a little bit, you know, richer in a way. And, oh, my gosh, I only did it one night. We sold it all out that night. And I felt so very much like I was walking in the footsteps of my grandmother. And that was a great day for me, cooking.
So you can reach us. You can join the conversation. You can call us 410-662-8780 or email us, foremanwolf@wypr.org. And let us know how you connect with your kids or who the great cook was that you actually felt safe with, that you could actually talk with. We've got some listener emails, And we're happy to take your calls on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You can reach us. I think we have a couple calls already on the way. It's 410-662-8780. We'll get to those in a moment. Or send us your emails, foremanwolf@wipr.org. And I've got one right on topic now from Robert. It says, good afternoon. My grandmother, born around 1900 in eastern Texas, of Welsh ancestry. Hmm. Made biscuits from scratch nearly every morning.
Oh, that's nice.
That's love right there.
Yes.
She used shortening wheat flour, shortening reed, lard, or Crisco, or right?
Sure.
Wheat flour and a rolling pin. Although I watched her numerous times, I need some guidance as to ingredient proportions. Can't seem to get the texture right.
I can share my buttermilk biscuit recipe. I'll give it to Luke and he can put it on the website.
Yeah, that'd be great.
It's fun to make biscuits. I will give you a hint though when making biscuits. You don't want to overwork the dough. So if you're doing it in the mixer,
the rolling pin is not your friend.
Nothing is your friend. Literally, your hands are the only friend you have, because you really want it to be done very gently. Tender biscuit. You have to be tender with it. Just think that way. And once the buttermilk is incorporated into the flour, you know, you're done, and get it out and just gently roll it out once. And, you know, you want it to be as thick as you want your biscuit to be. It's going to raise, obviously, a little bit, but, you know, hit it once with a cutter.
You're making savory pastry. You're not making bread. That's
right.
The thing.
Yeah, you're not. Exactly. You're not working the dough. You dock it with a fork and brush it with butter, with an egg, and bake it at 350. But I'll get you a recipe.
Docking it is your fancy term for poking holes in it.
Docking it, yes. And also the other thing is if you can find a soft winter wheat flour to make biscuits, like White Lily, that's what you want to make the best biscuits. So it's actually just, you know.
It's just less gluten.
It's lard, flour, yeah, buttermilk, and that, you know, a little salt, really. It's very few ingredients.
Another email from Deb. Fall is my favorite time of year for many reasons. Here is one of my favorite autumn desserts to make, individual whiskey pear trifles.
Mm.
And I was just talking to farmers,
that sounds so good.
Last pears, at least from close by, were in the market today.
Oh boy, really? They're over? Oh, that's okay. Go to market right now and get some, if they're still there.
Or drive to Michigan or something.
that's
which is
kind of
a different solution. individual whiskey pear trifles to make. Poach the pears in Irish whiskey and honey. That's
yum.
No joke poaching right there.
Right.
I'm assuming there'll be maybe some water in there as well.
Not straight whiskey.
We have our own beehives, so I use my backyard honey.
Oh my gosh, that's just
awesome.
That's perfection.
Serve them over cubes of pound cake with creme anglaise.
Is that a woman?
Yeah.
She's just making me happy.
Simple, but such a great taste of fall.
That's nice.
Happy autumn from Deb.
Thanks,
and there's
Deb.
A lovely photograph she sent us.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, I love that tablecloth. Look at that tablecloth.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet that's old.
Yeah. Sorry.
This is a great shot of her. Oh, she has it in like a tumbler glass. I love that.
Yeah,
her silverware is gorgeous.
We're always happy to see your food photographs if you want to send them. You can reach us.
Tablecloth.
ForemanWolf@WIPR.org with questions, but also tell us how something worked out. And then, let's see. We've got an email from Johnny. FYI, I'm a female named after my dad.
Oh, that's cool.
Let's see. I need help. When I make fruit muffins like blueberry, raspberry, or apple, they turn out great. Peaches, what can I say? Wet, yucky texture. Besides using dried peaches, what can I do?
Yeah, you know, I used to work with a pastry chef that made a custard tart, slightly different thing, but she used to roll her fruit in flour. And I think if it's small enough and maybe slightly drained, just so it's not, you know, completely, I mean, you know, don't dry them out. But yeah, maybe just rolled in a tiny bit of flour. You may just have to adjust your recipe. I mean, you're going to have to adjust your recipe for that product, obviously. So
one way some pastry chefs cheat is to use stuff that's slightly underripe because you're adding sugar to it. I'm not saying to do that.
No.
I don't advocate for that.
Right, no, I get it. But
I would advocate
it's more
for
firm,
ripe, fresh fruit that maybe. Did you dry it at a very low temperature, the slices, for a little while in the oven? You know, just get some of that water out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, honestly, I'd rather have a muffin that has an amazing preserve. Like, you know,
you could do that.
Like you make your batter, put them in the tins, and just literally take like a tiny spoon, an espresso spoon or something, and just put a nice fat dollop of that mm-hmm. preserve in there, and then you have a nice surprise when
you. That would be yummy. Well, yeah, that and muffin. That way you could just serve it with fresh peaches. Also, you know, it's like, why not just solve it that way? Enjoy your peaches fresh.
Yeah, I want the muffin to be like warm and buttery, and
I want a muffin
the,
right
the
now.
The fruit to be a treat.
Well, especially warm and buttery. That sounds so good. Can we talk to this person in Glendon, Tony?
Yeah, let's please do.
Marcy.
Marcy, go ahead. How are you?
Hello, Marcy.
You're on the air.
Uh-oh. All right. Maybe we lost Marcy.
You can get back to us, Marcy.
Do you have another one?
I do. I have another. We've got great emails today.
Good.
And you can reach us by phone as well, 410-662-8780. This is about the Chestnut program last week, or the other week. This is from Annette. I nearly went off the road with a discussion of chestnuts. Please don't freak out while you're driving and we're talking about food. Just go get something. I adore the little beasts. We used to roast them in the fireplace, and Mom showed me how to cut a cross in them before roasting to get the innards out.
Mm-hmm.
I cut my thumb trying to cross one when I was 4, and she had to leave the room for a minute. It looked easy.
Wow. Oh, gosh.
So maybe 4 is not the time your
to start,
child should
Well, chestnuts are very hard to deal with, so yeah, maybe not. Mm-hmm.
It's the things that always, like, I'm not going to let my kids cut carrots for a while.
Yeah.
Those are always...
Or butternut squash or spaghetti squash ever.
Roly.
Probably ever.
Yeah.
Ugh, those are hard for adults to cut into.
Yeah, you're lucky every time you'll cut into a spaghetti squash, it'll take your arm off.
Yeah, well, exactly. I finally brought my cleaver to work, my grandfather's cleaver.
There you go.
I just hack the thing with a cleaver.
Reminds me of that food show from the 80s that I love so much, One Can Cook. You know, where he would just had a giant, very small man, very loud, giant cleaver.
I never watched him, but I thought you were going to say it reminded you of Saturday Night Live when they imitated Julia Child, because sometimes I feel like that when I do work with a spaghetti squash, because I'm like, this could turn out badly.
When you get excited, your voice does get higher. Let me continue Annette's email. I am encouraged by your soup idea. I have used chestnuts in turkey stuffing as well as creamed. The easiest elegant dish for a group is chestnuts and Brussels sprouts. I'm down with that.
Mm-hmm.
I have gotten skins off by boiling them with a veggie steamer so they don't get direct heat, and removing them with a slotted spoon as they look done. It's a pain, and the skin on my thumbs takes a week to recover. You don't have to harm yourself in order to do this, Annette.
But
they are
though.
So darn good.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try your oven-roasted method this year.
Cool. So I went out to my old farm 2 days ago, something I should never do. And because it breaks my heart. And I went out there because I wanted to see if the chestnuts were falling off the trees. So my entire road was lined with chestnut trees.
Wait, did it?
I know. What? I didn't take any.
Isn't that your ex-road? Did you take the chestnuts?
I did not take any. I left them there for the new people. But yeah, well, there's the old milk road runs next to my driveway. Well, it's not my driveway anymore, but their driveway. So I take the old milk road and just sit there and, you know, kind of gaze across my old farm. And yeah, there are a bunch of chestnuts. So it's time to go find chestnuts, you guys, because they're out there. Oh, my goodness, they're starting to fall. So
we've got Marcy and Glendon back. Marcy, go ahead. You're on the air. Hello.
I heard you guys talking earlier about something kind of inspired or gave you confidence regarding cooking.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that would definitely be my grandmother. She just passed away a couple of months ago. So, you know, that was a big loss for our family, but just, you know, also a resource for me, for somebody who shared this interest. But so Rosh Hashanah is coming up, which is going to be my first one without being able to, like, call her and get advice. So
yeah.
I'm trying to, you know, use as many of her recipes as I can so we can kind of keep her with us in that way.
Good.
That's a nice time to celebrate that relationship.
Yeah, it's really nice. Probably the proudest moment of my cooking life was I found out that she had switched her challah recipe to one that I used, and I felt like that was a moment that I became like a full-fledged adult.
There
I was like
go.
30, but that was what did it.
Good.
So, it was just, you know, a really neat thing to share with her.
Very good.
That's awesome.
Celebrate her life
really
with those memories.
Chime in.
Thank you very
much. So what was the first thing that your grandmother taught you cooking-wise?
made mandel bread together when I was little, which when she passed away and we had the Shiva house was like kind of the first thing that occurred to me to make, to share with everybody who was coming to, you know, mourn with our family.
That's great.
Good.
Yeah, and delicious.
That's great, yeah. Never hurts.
Right. Thanks, Marcy.
Thank you. Bye.
Sure.
Bye.
And so you're welcome to reach us on that topic. We're talking about connecting with kids, being able to talk with kids, creating that safe space through cooking, through food, beginning to give them lessons, not just on, you know, how to remove butternut squash from the shell when it's cooked and that sort of thing. But though that is definitely one of the more fun things that you could have a small child do.
Well, or like with spaghetti squash, it's so cool when it does, you know, when it is cooked and you can just pull those strands of that out and gosh, doesn't it smell good?
I'm going to have to do that.
I love spaghetti squash so much. Are you going to tell me you don't like spaghetti squash now?
I like it very much. You know that.
I just did
some the other week for that charity brunch.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking, oh, my five-year-old, you know, she loves to rip things apart. So I'm certain that with a big spoon and a cooled off roasted spaghetti squash, she would have the best time.
Good. That's cool.
So
good.
That may be in our near future.
How it comes out. Certainly know why it's called spaghetti squash, that's for sure. A little bit of butter and gently cooked garlic, salt and pepper is really, and if you have a little tomato sauce like you were making today, if you have a little tomato sauce, especially I prefer one that's smooth with spaghetti squash. Oh my goodness. That's a good thing.
One that's pureed and strained.
Yeah. Seriously good thing. Spaghetti squash, tomato sauce,
spaghetti
butter,
sauce,
garlic.
Francais.
Oui. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Spaghetti sauce finished with butter.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. I know how you roll.
Exactly.
I know how you roll. We've got, from Cindy in Moncton. My husband planted a pawpaw tree a few years ago, and this year we have an abundance of these ugly fruits. What is the best way to take advantage of the flavor of these? Quick breads and muffins have been just okay so far. Thanks. So, Cindy, you're the pawpaw expert.
I was going to say, I don't know what that is. You know I don't know what that is. What's a pawpaw? Is that something local?
Mid-Atlantic.
Okay.
I
don't know what that is. Is it that red fruit, that scary red fruit that I see?
Make jelly.
Okay.
Make jelly.
Is it prickly on the, I mean, like, got, anyway.
Neither one of us, Cindy, is a pawpaw expert.
Yeah, when I
I'm
go
sure
home.
That now Cindy will be annoyed, so she's going to.
Oh, I will now find out.
Come
what
with some pawpaw.
Well, I don't like not knowing what it is.
Serve it with foie gras.
Oh, look, we are having
That's
help.
Some point.
Our
research department.
Okay, that's a papaya.
Yeah.
Pawpaw.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, I have to work on that.
Sorry, not seeing the photographs of papaya that the research department put up for pawpaws. You missed.
Okay. No. Got it.
Thanks, fellas.
Thank you. Go ahead, Tony. What's up?
At some point, we should get to northeast of Italy just a little bit.
Oh,
we
definitely.
We promised that in the beginning
Let's
of the
do
program.
It now. Let's do it now. We've talked enough about kids.
So, wow.
Just kidding. Uh-huh. All right.
What are the first things you think of food and wine wise when you think of that part of Italy? What are the cliches that come to mind?
Or do you even think about the northeast of Italy? Of course I do because I love it and it's my favorite food. But I think of canoodle and there are no cliches. I don't think of any cliches. I think of speck and canoodle and all the amazing cured meats and the cheeses from the region. And just the fact that it's not all about pasta, it totally surprised me the first time we went there. I had no idea that that was, of course, it makes sense. It's on the border with Austria. Of course, it's going to feel more.
Well, you're thinking all the, you're talking about
all the way north.
All the way north, the Alto Adige, the Südtirol, they call it, where German's the first language. There are five distinct regions in the northeast of Italy. The one that's probably the most famous and the one where most of the cliches come from is the Veneto, Venice being the largest, most important city, Verona being another famous city and a beautiful little city.
Oh, beautiful city.
That's there, but
Verona.
that's a well-populated and well-traveled part of Italy. And Suave, the white wine, Suave and Suave Classico are from there. Valpolicella is the most famous red wine from there. Amarone is the dried grape version of the red wine Valpolicella. And the these days ubiquitous sparkling wine Prosecco is from the Veneto. Mm-hmm. So, and there's a lot of Pinot Grigio produced in the Veneto. Though it honestly is not probably the best region for it in the northeast of Italy. But those four things are pretty dominant. Polenta is big there.
Mm-hmm.
Risotto, because the Po River Valley runs through there. I mean, those are two things that you expect there almost more than some pasta.
So they produce most of the arborio rice there then on the Po River, right? Or a lot of it?
And on a lot of those plains, they grow a lot of corn. So you have, like I said, polenta.
That's two good worlds, corn and rice.
And risotto, yeah. And you don't see it anywhere near as much because it's just not produced as much in the rest of Italy. But that's in the Veneto. East of the Veneto is Friuli. Friuli is on the Slovenian border. And the Friulani are people that speak their own language first. It's not a dialect. It's a separate language. It is definitely weirdly in between Italian. It's not a patois either. It's sort of in between Italian and Slovenian, and sounds a whole lot more Slavic than it does a Romance language. And polenta is a very big specialty in that area. And San Daniele is the famous prosciutto.
Oh, that's such a good ham.
That comes from there. Though the best versions of that I've had have all come from Slovenia outside of the DOCG.
Okay. Which interesting.
Yeah.
It's probably less expensive.
Well, I think there's some less regulation and it also that
San Daniele.
They will age them a little bit longer.
Mm, so even better.
Yeah, they get super buttery.
That's awesome.
But that's and that's mostly that's more white wine region than red wine region, and it's varietally driven, the reds being native varietals. But in all of these areas, outside of right along the Adriatic, there's not a ton of seafood. You have Trieste and Friuli, and you have Venice as the two ports, but otherwise everything is driven by the plains and then by the mountains north of there. You have Trentino, which is old Austrian Empire. And the city of Trento has the Austrian eagle as the symbol of the city,
mm-hmm.
though they still speak Italian as first language. And then north of there is the Alto Adige. And that's where everything changes to German completely.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some amazing food. Though the names are not quite as sexy for some of the dishes.
Who cares?
I mean, yeah, who doesn't
care.
Who
the food is so
who isn't
good.
Excited by a beautiful Schlutzkrapfen? You know?
I don't know anybody.
Or Canerli with Finfli, you know. I love them.
Oh, tell them about the tripe dish.
Oh, there's
and you said they killed it. Well, you were just there, so you had this experience
there's a restaurant up near the Austrian border that's been there a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely one of my five favorite places to eat in the world. And I mean, if you're having venison carpaccio, it's a red deer that was caught
so
on the
good.
Mountain, and
yeah.
and literally, you know that.
I will never forget having venison carpaccio there. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
They make all their own cheese. They raise all their own animals.
Mm-hmm.
The veal tripe is something that I love, and veal tripe. And the moment tomatoes are ripe for about 10 minutes in the Alto Adige, because of there's not a lot of red wine, there's not a lot of produce that ripens to that level.
It was pretty
there's
cool.
There's not enough heat. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool up there, so you're at pretty high
altitude.
At
the moment that happens, that you can make fresh tomato sauce, they braise the veal tripe in the tomato sauce from up there, which is marvelous.
Amazing. You have to be brave to eat tripe, but if you're going to eat it, that's the place to eat it. Well, yeah, some people don't know how to cook tripe. Tripe is not the easiest thing to cook, and you better know what you're doing if you're going to do it. It can be incredible. Obviously, you love it.
Here we are. Someone's going to fix us up. We have a local chef, Colin, who's going to tell us about pawpaw.
Hey there, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Good.
Good, good. So I'll give you a little spiel about what I know about pawpaw. So they're kind of like a greenish mango-like looking fruit. Usually have bruises from the roots, so I think that's why the lady said that they're ugly. Inside, they have large black seeds, but they have like a soft custard-like texture. Tastes almost like bananas and like mangoes combined.
Okay.
They are a local product, so they've been growing around the area for hundreds of years. There's actually writings about the pilgrims eating them when they came over. And if you look in some old Chesapeake cookbooks, they'll have recipes for pawpaw muffins and stuff like that, like the caller mentioned or the email mentioned. I think, personally, they shine best when they're kept raw. I like doing sorbets. Even like a creme brulee or something kind of goes along with the texture because they can get a little bit slimy when you cook them. Even the texture raw, I think, is something that people either like or don't like. I really like them, but I think, like some of the other chefs in my work, don't like them. So, yeah, that's pretty much what I've got. I know that there's a farm in Maryland, I believe in Frederick. I can't remember the name right now. But they have a huge pawpaw orchard, and that's actually where I get the pawpaw from. And I had the privilege of sampling, I think, 5 or 6 different varietals that they had. So they're basically just crossbreeds of the same plant, and they came out pretty different. So I thought that was really cool, and I think they're a great product. And I am jealous of anyone that has a tree.
That's awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in.
Appreciate it.
And,
yes.
Giving us the download.
Yeah, we needed to know that. Pawpaw, it also sounds like a...
Definitely get some if you can.
Thank you. We will work
on it.
Thanks,
Colin.
That's awesome. Thank you, Colin.
When we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, we'll take more of your calls, 410-662-8780. Read your emails, foremanwolf@wipr.org. And you never know, we might eventually get into a chef's challenge if Cindy feels like she's up to it. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf. And Tony, I want to know what the best food was you ate on your trip. I'm so excited that you went and got to do that.
It was great. It was fun to show a bunch of people some of those areas because I know you've been up that way. And especially when you go up to the Alto Adige, I feel like that's one of the really hidden. If you want to take the Food & Wine vacation, have it be not an insane price and be really inspired and find a huge variety of things that you don't always see in the States. The Alto Adige, north of Verona, north of Lake Garda.
Mm-hmm.
The most important city is Bolzano. But where you want to be is on the two sort of giant hillsides that run north all the way to the Brenner Pass. And they're just remarkable stuff. I mean, the filled pastas like the Schlutzkrapfen, great. Speck, as you mentioned, is the one smoked prosciutto made in Italy. And that can be marvelous.
And you eat that. What's interesting about that is you do eat thin slices of it just on its own.
Yeah.
That's how you eat it. And it doesn't seem like necessarily you would eat it that way, but it's so good. If you're scared of fat, don't order it.
No, but it's not
delicious.
Terrible. If you're scared of fat, don't order lardo. Which is just
or
purely,
yeah, you know,
just pure cured
all fat, right,
from a pig.
Mm-hmm.
But the game is remarkable. I mean, there's a huge variety that you can have in various places. All the organ meats and stuff, which can be scary to some people, you'll find them hidden in pleasant ways in pastas and things like that. there you see much more pasta and noodles and much less, as you would think, as you realize the mountainous region, you're not going to grow that much corn. You're not going to grow rice.
Mm-hmm.
That's down on the plains and the lowlands. So that's really what you see up there. Canoodle, as you mentioned, or the other name that you often see for these dumplings are canedoli. And they're literally crushed bread dumplings soaked in stock or broth. And they'll be studded with speck or with roasted chanterelle mushrooms or vegetables of the season, like nettles in the spring or wild asparagus. I mean, they can be just unbelievable. Traditionally served just in more broth. But a lot of times, just like in the summertime, with like a cabbage salad with speck and a variety of those can be.
Aren't there a lot of orchards there? If I recall,
huge number.
Yeah. So
80% of the apples that are sold in Italy are coming out of that valley.
Because I think we were there one year when they were blossoming, and that was one of the prettiest things ever.
Yeah,
was seeing all those fruit trees with their blossoms on. Wow, it was pink and pink.
Up in the Dolomites, especially this time of the year, fantastic time to be there. The days of 80 degrees and nights in like the, in the 50s.
That's so great. Gosh.
And that's lunch outside and, cozy dinner inside kind of territory.
Great. Well, yeah, you can get a fire going.
And not particularly fancy, though there are a bunch of like one-star Michelin restaurants dotted around if you're willing to take a long, ridiculous mountain road drive.
You went to the Zoner, right? Did you eat there?
It's Zucrona.
Zucrona,
yeah, which is a marvelous traditional restaurant. Same family since the 1530s had this little hotel.
1530s? Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Our research department and producer are shaking their heads at the 1530s. The 1530s.
What did you eat there?
The famous dish, there is a river fish that they call, in Italian, it's salmarino. It looks an awful like a fat trout. I think the nickname being little salmon, it's because it's, because salmons are pretty like chunky in the middle compared to like other flat fish. Mm-hmm. And for river fish to be sort of fat in the middle like that be a pike is very unusual. Mm-hmm. So, but it's like a rich trout and cooked in the pan in whole butter, whole fish.
Thank you.
Lots of sage. Lots of black pepper and speck. And speck cooking in the butter at the same time. So you get the fat and the smoke from the pork.
Oh my.
On the trout.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think you're up for Chef's Challenge?
I don't think we have time.
No?
All right, go ahead.
Oh, that's
all right,
just...
we'll do a really quick Chef's Challenge. All right, go ahead. All right. There we go.
I mean, that's, I knew you were going to...
Oh, you gave me polenta, lemon, sage, butternut squash, green tomatoes, sweet peppers, Concord grapes, chicken sausage, venison leg, smoked bacon, Granny Smith apples, yams. Oh, I love yams. Okay, so roast the yams in the oven, oil, salt, pepper on the outside, get them nice and tender. I'm going to braise the venison leg and red wine.
What are you going to braise it in?
Oh, you didn't give me anything to braise it in?
No.
I'm grilling the venison leg. I'm going to...
You're
going to
cut...
Put some smoked bacon on it. I'm just going to grill it as a whole leg. And I'm going to lay some of that smoked bacon on there. You gave me chicken sausage, like already made? That's weird, Tony.
Yes, I did.
And so when I go to slice...
People
and
like
I'm going to
chicken
cook the
sausage.
Venison leg, when I go to slice it nice and thin, I'm going to add Granny Smith or serve it with Granny Smith apples and the Concord grapes. I'm going to roast the sweet peppers and those things will be together. I'm going to cook the polenta in water, apparently, because I don't have anything else with salt.
Back up one second. I'll give you dairy for the polenta.
Uh-huh.
So you're going to do the sweet peppers, the Concord grapes, and the apples.
Uh-huh. Together as the garnish for the venison.
As almost sort of like a salad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
That's great.
Thank you, Tony, for approving.
No, I like that. I like that.
The sage would have been a rub on that venison leg that you gave me, so I would have chopped the sage a little bit and probably not too fine and just mixed it with olive oil that you didn't give me because you've given me basically nothing here. And I'm going to...
I said dairy.
Dice the green tomatoes and add them to the diced butternut squash and saute it all in butter. And I'll add the green tomatoes at the end because it will be really, really good with the butternut squash and serve it with the polenta. Okay, your turn.
Okay, woo.
You're all... That was abrupt.
Yeah, that was... Yeah, come on, I'm not that
speedy. Oh, you have a lot of food.
Yeah, a side of salmon.
A side
of full salmon. Pantry. Well, that's generous.
Mm-hmm.
Four lobsters, lobster stock, mm-hmm. lima beans, chanterelles, pears, eggs, cream eggs, eggs on the brain, Brussels sprouts, squash, chestnuts. What I want is the poach the lobsters. That salmon, I want to open up that salmon and I want to stuff it with the chanterelles and the pears. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm going to... Close it up, mm-hmm. season it, mm-hmm. and roast in the oven. What? I'm going to roast them in the oven. What's wrong with chanterelles and pears together? Come on now. Lobster stock I want for a soup, garnished with lima beans and a little bit of leftover lobster meat. Brussels sprouts, squash, chestnuts. What kind of squash?
Butternut.
Butternut. Well, that's kind of an easy, like, autumn mix of veg. Just blanch the Brussels sprouts, roast the squash, dice the squash, roast the chestnuts, everything saute in butter. Maybe seasoned with a little bit of allspice or something.
What are you serving that with?
Serving it with a plate as a side dish. Okay. With a slice of the salmon.
It's its own thing.
With the salmon that
upset
you.
Oh, with the salmon, no. Yeah. Salmon didn't upset me.
Salmon upset you. Yeah.
I just don't want to eat it.
Oh,
with
I don't believe
pears
that.
Pears and chanterelles
now,
inside
okay,
of it.
Okay, now I'm going to have to make it. Now I'm going to have to make it. Now you upset
oh,
me.
Oh, boy.
The mm-hmm. eggs, I don't want eggs for any of these things.
You have
give
to
me
use
eggs
them.
Twice.
You have to use them.
I have to use them for what?
Yeah, well, you have to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to make an egg-based sauce. I don't do that.
Uh-huh. All right.
What? I'm just...
Maybe you could brush the chanterelles and the pears with some eggs.
No, I mean, you could certainly make hollandaise because you gave me butter
well,
and the eggs.
Well, there you
and,
go. See? I knew you could do it. All right. Hollandaise sounds good.
And serve that with
it
the salmon.
It likes salmon.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to... What's your next project in teaching your kids how to cook? Do you have something in mind? Or it's just, you know, I'm sure it's just, you know, every day. But is there something you wish they would?
We need some work on some very basic, safe knife skills. Even if it's just like slicing bananas.
Sure.
You know, or cutting bread into
quadrants. So you think your oldest daughter,
like
who is, what,
five
yeah. is old enough to use a knife? Okay.
To do very basic, easy things.
And a little knife, yeah.
Very basic, easy things.
Okay.
Getting the attention span to do it repetitively.
Yeah.
I think a little tough.
I think table manners are also another thing that's part of that whole equation. The whole table. You know, everything about the table.
The table
is
a place
learning.
For gymnastics, if you ask my daughters.
Well.
Because you eat, you do gymnastics.
So when I was a little girl, I used to try to sing at the table. Okay,
yeah,
that didn't go over
no,
too well.
That's, I'm yeah, glad you're a chef and not a singer.
And I used to like to stand on my chair, too.
Yeah,
but none of those things were allowed.
Okay. Yeah, that's... No. Right. Anyway, that's all your bad behavior as a child is past now. Thank goodness. If you want to correspond with us via email, you can reach us foremanwolf@wipr.org. You can download this or any one of our other episodes on the WIPR website, wipr.org. Look for the Foreman Wolf page, and there's a full menu of goodies there for you. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Instagram as Chef Wolf and on Facebook as Chef Cindy Wolf. And I am back on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf. So
on,
you have three
off,
choices. I'm everywhere.
Oh, my gosh. And you can follow me on Instagram, The Real Tony Foreman.
There you go.
Thanks so much for listening.
Happy Sunday.